The Nick DeGilio Show continues here on a Sunday night into Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because that's what we do here on Monday morning, and that'll be coming up later on. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Artist and musician China Blue will be joining us to talk about her latest album, Cassini's Dreams, and more. We're going to talk about weird American traditions as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Every Sunday night into Monday morning, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to talk about the new movies, and we're going to do just that. But also, they just got back from the Sundance Film Festival, so we're going to get some exclusive looks at some of the movies that they saw there. Let's say hello to Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
Okay. Let's get to the new movies. We don't have much to talk about in terms of new movies here. It's been a little slow lately. Mm-hmm. So let's go to Sundance. Eric, why don't you start out? Where do you want to go here?
How about we talk about Horse Girl?
Okay.
Because this is actually going to be premiering on Netflix, I believe, this upcoming Friday, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's February 7th.
Okay.
And this one is a new film from Jeff Baena, whose last film actually opened our film festival, called The Little Hours. And this one was not just directed by him, but co-written by him and the star of the movie, Alison Brie. And she plays a very nice, sweet, if socially awkward, woman who works at an arts and crafts store. She's started to realize things have been kind of slipping a little bit. She's starting to have sort of weird visions in her life, and she's starting to wonder if this might have something to do with sort of an ancestral medical issue that has resolved, come up in her family, or is she just tapping into something that she's been seeing on a supernatural television show. So as the movie sort of progresses, we sort of watch her kind of slowly slip in and out of her own reality, what starts off as kind of a sweet, funny, almost potentially awkward romantic comedy, then begins to sort of delve into much more serious territory as the film goes along. This is a film that more or less rests on the strength of Alison Brie's performance, which I really have to say I think might have actually been my favorite performance at the festival this year. I think she's absolutely extraordinary in this movie. And it's a film, I think, you know, there'll be some comparisons, I think, to Take Shelter a bit. Most people like that movie a lot more than I do. But this one I found is, you know, takes the subject matter. It doesn't cheapen what she's going through. It has kind of an element of a mystery to it, but again, treats it with such sensitivity that it's not kind of glamorizing in any way, or you know, putting any kind of sort of hysterical spin on it. And like I said, it really rests on the strength of Brie's performance, and I think she's really great in this movie.
You know, it's interesting. What's happened to her career, and she's become a really, really terrific and interesting actress. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is the Nick DeGilio Show here on 720 WGN. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here. Steve, where do you stand on this one?
Yeah, I mean, at its core, and you may not realize it until pretty deep into the film, is this is a film about mental illness. It's actually not just co-written by Alison Brie, but she has said that it is based to a large degree on some issues she had with mental illness earlier in her life. And so this is not a comedy at all. It's not entirely a deadly serious film. It's more about paranoia and is she mentally ill, or are these things happening to her and they're just so far-fetched that no one, including herself, can even believe it. I mean, we're talking about issues maybe dealing with alien abduction and cloning, and like there's all these, you know, all the garden variety conspiracy theories all seem to be happening to her at the same time, and we along with her have no idea if any of it's true, and it's maddening sometimes, and I mean that in a good way. It's like we really don't know, and they don't give up the secrets very easily, and even when they do, I'm not sure I could pass a test on this movie. But it really is about the sort of tenuous grasp that we all have about the difference between being awake and being asleep and dreaming and hallucinating, and it's a really bold and disquieting character study. I really enjoyed this film.
Okay, all right, and it is coming on Netflix Friday.
Mm-hmm.
It will be available on Netflix.
At least so, yeah.
Yeah, it is available. I'm looking at it right now. It's available on February 7th on Netflix, and it's called Horse Girl. I'm really fascinated by where Alison Brie's career has gone. It's just been so much fun to watch her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the way back to, you know, Community.
Sure.
And I just think she's great. So it's good to hear. All right. Let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about Lost Girls?
Lost Girls is based on a pretty popular true crime novel that came out in 2013, and it tells us right off the bat that this is based on this true story that is an unsolved mystery. So we know off the bat by the end of the film we are not going to have all the answers. But it's about this mother who's played by Amy Ryan. Her name is Marie Gilbert, and her eldest daughter Shannon goes missing in this sort of affluent Long Island neighborhood, and Marie wants answers, and because her daughter was a drug addict, or possibly a drug addict and definitely a prostitute, the local police don't really seem to want to give this mystery of her disappearance the time of day, and so she really has to fight with them and sometimes embarrass them publicly, these authorities, to really get them to have any interest in the case, even if it's just to shut her up. So, you know, we learn about what happened to, like, Shannon's life, the sort of online sex worker, and then we find out that other girls in this general vicinity have also disappeared, and then bodies start getting found almost by accident by the police, and although not Shannon's initially, and the film is not so much about the mysteries, but it's about this back and forth between these mothers of these missing or dead girls and the police, and just trying to just care for like 2 seconds about who might have committed this. Is this a serial killer? Like, and again, this is all real. The head of the police force is led by a commissioner played by Gabriel Byrne, who's very good in the film. And, when Marie she's sort of like the Erin Brockovich of missing girls, I guess, and she just really dedicates her life, and the police kind of counter her by pointing out some really ugly examples of what a bad mother she was, when Shannon was much younger. The filmmaker is a documentarian named Liz Garbus, who did a film a couple years ago about Nina Simone, and also did a great, her first film, I think, was called The Farm. And this is just a terrific, she kind of uses her documentary style a little bit to make this feel very authentic. Amy Ryan, obviously, no surprise, is commanding in this role. And it really sort of digs up in this dark side of the American psyche and reveals these forgotten voices. I should also mention Thomasin McKenzie from Jojo Rabbit shows up as Marie's middle daughter. She has three, and the police sort of paint Marie as a terrible mother, including with the two daughters she has now. But that doesn't deter her. This is a heavy, dark story about a case, like I said, that still hasn't been completely solved. But man, is it! And this is also a Netflix film, by the way. Although I'm not exactly sure when it's coming out,
March 13th.
There you go. So March 13th, and I highly recommend it. It is really harrowing and sometimes upsetting, but it has a real honesty to it. And just like I said, Amy Ryan. When is she ever bad, really?
Never. Never. No, never. The answer to that question is never. So.
Yes.
All right. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress are with us, and we're going to talk new movies, and we're doing a Sundance. They just got back from the Sundance Film Festival, so we're getting like exclusive reviews of some of the movies that they saw at Sundance, and some of which we'll be able to see in the coming weeks and months. Okay, and we continue the conversation with Eric and Steve right here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're going into a Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk with artist and musician China Blue a little bit later on. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text anytime you want to jump in. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress joined me to review the new movies, which we'll get to. And they just got back from Sundance and are giving us exclusive looks at some of the movies they saw at Sundance that we'll get to see at some point, too. So Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. Eric, where do you want to go next?
Well, I mean, you know, Sundance can sometimes be a very dark week of movie going. The way we just started off this segment with mental illness and sex trafficking, for Pete's sake. But in the middle of the week, we got a really wonderful palate cleanser in the form of the movie that ended up breaking the Sundance sales record set by The Birth of a Nation a few years ago, and that's a movie called Palm Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And this film, it stars Andy Samberg, who's now just set the Sundance sales record on the Andy Samberg film. Appropriately enough, we are still on Groundhog Day, and I know some people have been trying to skirt around the premise of this movie, but it's not really a spoiler to say that this movie more or less belongs in what seems to be a Groundhog Day cinematic universe that we have now between the Harold Ramis film and Edge of Tomorrow and even some things on Netflix that I've seen. Andy Samberg plays a guy that is in a really bad relationship. He's at a wedding in the middle of the desert, like Arizona, and he finds himself stuck in a time loop. But the movie doesn't begin sort of where Groundhog Day does. It basically begins sort of where Bill Murray had ended up in Groundhog Day, very much further down the pike is when we first meet the Andy Samberg character. He ends up accidentally bringing in another person from the wedding into the time loop with him to share this, you know, either wonderful or horrible experience, depending on what day it is, or the same day. She's played by Kristen Milioti. And so the two of them basically figure out how much fun they can have reliving this day over and over again, getting to know each other along the way, and then how long it's going to take for them to figure out how to get out of this thing, or if they even want to get out of it. I don't want to spoil too much of the film, because there are several really weird surprises along the way. And the really wonderful thing about this movie, besides it being hysterically funny, is that it really belongs in sort of the same cloth as the Harold Ramis film, because it doesn't just play itself up as just a retread. Many lazy, you know, versions of that story, you know, could be made, you know, over and over again, no pun intended. But this one really sort of expands. You know, it saw what worked at Groundhog Day, and it plays up some of those very same angles. But then it finds detours. It finds different areas to explore, and then actually comes upon some really kind of interesting and profound moments of human wisdom along the way of, you know, the lives that these characters are, you know, are stuck within. And it ultimately, you know, becomes this really sweet, really funny movie that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, give it all the money in the world. Neon picked up the movie. The previous record was $17.5 million. This one sold for $17.5 million and 69 cents. Yeah. yeah, and Palm Springs, it doesn't have a release date yet, but I suspect you'll probably be seeing this sometime in the summer.
Okay. All right. So, Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This is a feature debut from the director, and it's kind of a, you start thinking it's like lighthearted and it's playful, which it is, absolutely. But then sort of peppered throughout it are these really wonderful messages about loneliness and connection and existence and identity and love. And It actually is a very moving story, and like Eric said, a very sweet story. And it's funny because this is not only an Andy Samberg film; it's technically a Lonely Island production because the three guys all produced the film too. So you'd think it was something a little sillier, but this is pretty solid sometimes. And Eric, you forgot of course the Happy Death Day movies as part of this small universe
very
of films.
True, yeah,
so,
right.
Anyway, but I don't know how you could do that, but
very easily.
Anyway,
actually,
yeah, I mean it's surreal and it's sort of unexpected in a lot of ways, and actually, really, we enter the film through the female lead, through this character named Sarah, who's a bridesmaid and the sister of the bride, if I'm not mistaken, and she's kind of the black sheep of the family. So she's kind of a miserable human being who doesn't really care if she messes up this wedding. And then Sandberg's character kind of comes in and just surprises her and is weird, but somehow knowing, and we don't know exactly. I can't wait to see this film again because I think I'm going to see things I didn't catch the first time before it's revealed sort of that we're in this loop. I should also mention that there's a great ensemble cast, especially J.K. Simmons is another wedding guest who seems to have it out for Sandberg for reasons I won't go into, but yeah, this was a nice surprise, like Eric said, in the middle of a bunch of kind of heavy films, so yeah. Heartily recommend it.
Okay, that's Palm Springs with Andy Sandberg right here, and it did get picked up by Neon, and it is Nick DiGilio on the Nick DiGilio Show, having a conversation with Eric and Steve after they've gotten back from the Sundance Film Festival, so we're getting some exclusive looks at that. 312-981-7200 here on WGN. Okay, Steve, what about The Nest?
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad glad this is mine. All right. So this is a film that teaches us that the only thing worse than rich people are people who used to be rich and are trying to pretend that they still are to save face, basically. Jude Law plays a guy named Rory, who's a British guy. He's sort of an ambitious entrepreneur and a commodities broker who lives in the United States. With his American wife, who's played by Carrie Coon, the great Carrie Coon, and who's a professional horse trainer and is very successful at her job too, and they have two kids. And they live this very comfortable, you know, they're very well off, and they live pretty comfortably in the United States. But he is sort of tempted by a job opportunity back in his native England and going back to a firm he used to work for. And I should mention this is set in the 80s, so the idea of being greedy, as we know, is not such a terrible thing as it is today, necessarily, in certain circles. But anyway, he sort of seizes this opportunity, heads back, just sort of uproots everybody begrudgingly, and goes back there, buys a huge mansion. I mean, it looks like Downton Abbey, for God's sakes, and that he can't afford. But it's got room on the grounds for his wife to build up her horse training again and stables. And so as the days and months go by in this new job, he keeps missing out on these big deals, and they start getting pressed for money, and he lies to just about everybody, including his family, about how broke they are. And man, it just really digs into the corrosive value system of the 80s and the toll it took on certain people. And as much as I know it's sometimes hard to feel bad for rich people who behave like this, these performances, Jude Law and Carrie Coon, are so damn good in this movie that you're not really supposed to feel bad for them as much as you are just supposed to understand that they've kind of built this moral prison for themselves, and they're sort of taking everyone down with them. And it's a movie about self-destruction, but also, you know, the marriage starts to fall apart, not surprisingly, and you're kind of put in the situation where you either or know it's going to explode or implode, or they're going to somehow pull it together. And every member of the family, including the kids, starts acting in a self-destructive way too. I was particularly excited to see this film because it's the second feature from Sean Durkin, whose first film was Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. And this is a different film on the surface, although it is sort of about these isolated people and how that isolation can be slightly, like I said, corrosive at times. And yeah, I mean, it just kind of turns your stomach sometimes about where things go here, but it really sort of hones in on the emptiness of of an aspirational society, and I feel like that's a lesson we could use right now. Even though this film is set in the 80s, I think we have to revisit this idea very soon. So yeah, it is a terrific film.
Yeah, and Carrie Coon, you know, goes without saying how great she is. And right now you can see her on stage at Steppenwolf here.
I'm going in like 3 weeks.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
She's in Bug. All right. I will find out what Eric thinks of this movie when we continue our conversation. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're talking with Steve and Eric, and they're doing a little roundup of the Sundance Film Festival, and we'll hear what Eric thought of The Nest coming up here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. It is Sunday night into Monday morning, and on Mondays, my dad always calls in and tells a joke, so that's coming up. We have artist and musician China Blue. We're going to talk with her about her new album. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right now, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me, as they do every week, to talk to new movies. They just got back from the Sundance Film Festival, and we're getting some exclusive reviews of movies that they saw there. Eric, tell us what you thought of The Nest.
Not as much as Steve thought about it. This is on the ground at Sundance. My sort of whole review of the movie was, I kind of shrugged my shoulders and went, rich people, huh? And the movie reminded me a lot of the film The New Age with Peter Weller.
Yeah,
was a film that it struck a very similar chord to that. But this one, despite what Steve was saying, you know, it being set in the 80s and kind of being a reflection of that period, you know, because the movie plays a couple of 80s songs, and that's pretty much the entire identifying crux I think the movie has with the 80s, it didn't ring that true to me. I just didn't really care about these characters. And like Steve said, I don't think the movie is asking you to necessarily sympathize with these people. They all sort of go down the same trudge throughout the movie, and none of them are particularly that likable. They're all kind of, you know, horrible in different ways. And the film also doesn't really have a satiric tone, I think, to these characters. So by the end of the movie, when everything has, you know, pretty much unraveled, you just kind of go like, yeah, that's kind of what you get. And I just kind of walked away thinking just that. So I didn't have a very strong reaction to it.
Okay. All right. Eric, tell us about 9 Days.
Okay. Well, this actually make a pretty interesting double feature with Palm Springs, in a way, although this one is definitely not a comedy. The Winston Duke, the great Winston Duke from Us and Black Panther, plays what can best be described as, I guess, a soul overseer, particularly pre-born souls. He's sort of in the middle of this, like, almost like heavenly limbo type, middle of the desert area, where he reviews tapes all day, VHS tapes on many televisions, and is given the task of a number of pre-born souls who are all shown in grown human form, and determine which one of them gets the opportunity to live in the body of a human on Earth. So along with Benedict Wong, who plays an assistant of his, some of the souls are played by Zazie Beetz and Bill Skarsgård and Tony Hale. It's definitely not a comedy. It's a movie that is really trying to delve into a lot of really greater truths about human existence. But it's never an uninteresting film. It's kind of a really kind of slow burn, trying to really get inside the heads of these souls who are reviewing these same tapes and trying to figure out what it is or what it should be to be human. But it just leads to an incredibly emotional payoff with Winston Duke in a final scene that is just the icing on a cake that I think is a really fascinating movie. It's the kind of movie, it's a movie that you're going to want to see more than once to sort of grasp, again, the sort of layers within it. But it makes for, again, with Palm Springs and that makes for a very interesting double feature.
All right, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the best things I saw this year. It's weird. It's a Brazilian writer-director, but he's based in Los Angeles. The film actually won a screenwriting award at Sundance, and it's just you have to sort of envision. I know it sounds really trippy, but it's just like a little way station out in the middle of the desert. That's sort of the visualization, and these people are essentially just being tested, and Winston Duke is giving them different scenarios and saying, how would you react to this? And he judges them based on that as to whether he thinks they're ready to be human. And he can only pick one of about like eight people or something like that, and for eight souls, I guess. And so it gets like supernatural and metaphysical, and it's packed with really deep human emotions, and a lot of these souls don't really know how to react. I got to point out in particular, Tony Hale, it's such a different kind of role for him. And as much as you might think he's brought in for comic relief, he absolutely is not, although he is funny at sometimes, but it's a pretty deadly serious role for him. The film kind of gets you in the head and the heart, and like Eric said, it's just sort of propelled by this incredible performance by Winston Duke. And I honestly, of all the films I saw at Sundance by first-time filmmakers, this is the one that I just remember thinking, I cannot wait to see what this guy comes up with next, because if this is even any indication of where his mind is going to take us, I can't wait. I can't wait. And yeah, and the ending is just mind blowing. Yeah.
Okay. And Zazie Beetz. I mean, please.
Of course. Yeah.
A role of substance, actually, Nick.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
For a change.
Yeah. All right. Okay. It's the Nick DiGilio show here on 720 WGN. We're talking with Steve and Eric, as we do every week, to talk about the movies. And they just got back from Sundance. We're getting some exclusive looks at some of the stuff that they saw. All right, Steve.
Yeah.
Please tell me about Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist.
Oh, yeah. This is actually one I saw just after Sundance, because it premiered, I think, after we left. But this is the latest from Alexandre O'Philippe, who I think it was just last year had a fantastic documentary called Memory about the making of Alien.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, and then he also made a film called 7852 about the shower scene in Psycho.
Yep.
He made a movie I know you and I both saw, Nick, called Dock of the Dead.
Yep.
So this guy is like the ultimate film essayist. And so here he has, and actually when I interviewed him last year about Memory, he had already done the like 6 days of interviews with William Friedkin, and it's just about The Exorcist. But of course it's not just about The Exorcist, it's about all the elements that went into the visuals and the writing and the performances and just every possible corner of the making of this film. And this is not a traditional making of documentary at all. And the detail, and it just feels like he caught Friedkin in a great time about a year ago, and just got him to talk about the narrative spine of the film. And a lot of the visuals, actually, and specific even lighting choices came from paintings that Friedkin saw at the Art Institute when he grew up in Chicago. And they go back and they look at those paintings. And now Friedkin's the only interview in the film. They don't talk to anybody else who made the film. This is strictly about a guy's personal vision. You know, obviously he gets very into the authors, I guess he did a screenplay that Friedkin didn't like at all. He thought it took out all the really great stuff, so he had to sort of work with him to get it right. But this thing even gets deep into like Max von Sydow not being an atheist, and how it was tough for him initially to play a priest and to really believe in some of the things he has to believe in, especially toward the end of the film. It is a remarkable, illuminating film that the analysis is like a must see for cinephiles. And I mean, this is one of my one of the all time greatest horror films, one of the all time greatest films, period, and certainly one of my all time favorites. So, this is just candy for me.
Yeah, it sounds great. All right, Eric.
Yeah, no, this is really, really great stuff. I mean, I had some issues with his Alien documentary from last year, primarily the amount of talking heads that he did employ to talk about that movie. It often felt like, you know, a bunch of, you know, film geeks who, you know, kind of just discovered the hidden meanings to Alien that any film geek has known for 40 years, and there's sort of a kind of a smugness to their, you know, like, look what I just found. With this one, it's just Friedkin. It is just from the you know, the creator's mouth, and he's the only voice you hear in the movie, with the exception of the, you know, any clips that are played from the, you know, the movie or any other accompanying films that were influences. And it's just, I mean, I could have watched this for, you know, another 4 hours just listening to Friedkin talk about his you know, his style, things that would not go over today, things that he did on the set. Some anecdotes we've heard before and other things, but there are definitely some new bits of information, and just hearing the passion and the know-how that, you know, coming from him, and ultimately leading him to his own sort of spiritual awakening. I mean, this is a man who's been around for a long time. He's in his mid-80s, and sort of the leap of faith that he comes to by the end of this documentary is really quite moving as well. This is a really terrific piece of work that is, I mean, it's not just candy for Steve and I. It should be candy for anyone who loves The Exorcist or film, period.
Yeah. Well, you know, I could listen to Friedkin talk for hours. He was one of the, you know, I've had him on the show twice. He's one of the best interviews I've ever had.
Yeah.
He's a great guy and a terrific filmmaker. That's called Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist. Has that been picked up at all?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, you guys, hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, Steve, we will continue our conversation here, talking about, we'll wrap up the Sundance stuff, and then there's a couple of new movies to review here on 720 WGN. Giglio show continues here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio on now officially a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are going to visit with artist and musician China Blue to talk about her new album. Really interesting way she put this album together, too. We'll talk about that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are going to talk about the Super Bowl ads from last night. And some of the weird traditions that we have, American traditions, and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us here for talk or text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress join me every Sunday night, Monday morning to review movies, and we're going to get to a couple of new ones here, and then the box office as well. We got Eric and Steve. Hi, guys.
Hello.
All right. Eric, tell us about Sylvie's Love.
Okay. I don't have a whole lot to say about this movie. It's a film. It's a romance featured around sort of an African-American neighborhood in a city set in, I believe, it's the 1960s. Steve, is it the 1960s?
I think it's the late 50s. Starts in the late 50s.
Okay, yeah, that sounds about right.
But it goes through into the 60s.
It stars Tessa Thompson, And I'm sorry, Steve. Do you remember the name of the other actor?
Oh, I know it, but I could not pronounce it to help to save my life. No, sorry.
He's very good, but good actor. And I feel bad that I don't have his name handy. Her father, played by Lance Reddick, owns a record shop that she tends to during the day, and this young male musician who does jazz at around the clubs in the area comes into the store and gets a job there, and they form a relationship. They have a bit of a romance that then gets kind of torn apart over the years as he goes on to travel with his band, and she develops her own life, and they come back together. And this movie, you know, spanning several years of their time together, not to put too fine a point on it, but watching the movie, it very much felt like if Beale Street Could Talk existed in La La Land, in a way, just minus the musical numbers. A lot of jazz. A lot of jazz music in this movie, and a lot of really good music, and the romance between the two actors, who are both very good in the film, is palatable and nice, and that's pretty much how you can describe the movie. You can't really say anything much more about it than just say it's just kind of nice. It's sort of framed in the sort of the kind of the Douglas Sirk era of filmmaking, but the filmmaker who did this one, it's one of those cases where it seems like they know the words, but in this case, not the music. And it just the art direction and the costume design, a lot of work was put into that. But the sort of the lack of conflict in the movie, it just kind of results that everyone's going to make decisions that are more kind of predecided by the screenplay, rather than any sort of naturalistic thing or things that might surprise us to sort of bring these characters together or tear them apart. There's nothing necessarily bad about the movie. It's watchable. It just didn't really do a whole lot more for me beyond that.
Okay. Steve, what about you?
Yeah, this is an interesting thing because some of the criticism of the film at Sundance was that it's got an almost entirely black cast, but they don't really deal that much with racial issues, and so it doesn't really have the bite of a film about like a message or anything. But then I thought, I'm like, well, why does that matter? Why can't we just put black characters in the same situations where we put white characters before? This is an unapologetic romance. It's got these wonderful sort of musical accents to it, and certainly Tessa Thompson and the lead actor have chemistry for days. He is supposed to be a very talented sort of rising star as a saxophonist, and she is someone who has had pretty big dreams for both a woman and a black woman in the 50s and 60s. And she tends to realize most of them during the course of the film without too much struggle, and that might seem like it does come across, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it comes across as a fantasy in a lot of ways. And so what? Like that, I like that about it. It's a slight film. It's a small film, and I think in subtle ways it does sort of have some of those messages to it, but maybe not in the story as much as just the execution. And Eric's right, the production design and the costumes make this movie look very expensive when it probably wasn't very expensive at all. I love the soundtrack to it especially, but this is a melodrama about the unstoppable force of love, and they kind of slip in and out of being with each other in a lot of the same ways that they do in La La Land. But it's an interesting. I can't imagine how people are going to respond to this, but I responded pretty favorably. There's not a lot to it, but I was never bored. I just kind of let it wash over me in the end. I just kind of gave myself over to it.
Okay. I happen to love Tessa Thompson.
Sure. She's great.
She's
great in this.
All right, cool. That's called Sylvie's Love, and that was also at Sundance. Okay, let's get to the new ones. Steve, you saw Gretel and Hansel?
Oh, yeah.
All right, tell us about it.
Once upon a time, in a distant fairy tale countryside, there's a young girl who leads her little brother into a dark wood in search of food and work. And after their mother sort of descends into madness and sends them out on their own. And if this sounds familiar, it's the Hansel and Gretel story, but sort of, I think Gretel is aged up a little bit and is played by the great Sophia Lillis, who we've seen in the It movies and Sharp Objects, and she was even at a film we saw at Sundance called Uncle Jack. Not a very good film, but a film. And so these siblings sort of have to fend for themselves in the unforgiving woods, and they're hungry and they're scared. They meet up with this kindly hunter who gives them advice not to leave the path as they continue on to the next big town where they hopefully will find the work that they are looking for. But of course, they stumble upon a bounty of food left in this isolated home, seemingly empty. But they find out that there is, in fact, an old woman living there, who's played by the great Alice Krieg, and they are invited inside and eat up and have lovely beds to sleep in. But it doesn't take long for the kids to suspect that maybe this generous woman and mysterious woman's behavior is a part of something much more sinister, and she means to do them harm. Before she kind of carries out her plan, she takes particular interest in Gretel and decides she might be a worthy recipient of some of her knowledge of natural remedies and other potions and spells. And it doesn't take long for us to figure out that this older woman is a witch. And she spies some sort of natural abilities in Gretel. Look, the film has a fantastic old school horror vibe to it that isn't particularly scary, but it's really creepy and beautifully realized just visually. Krieg is fantastic at sort of walking that line between being inviting and hospitable and then also being threatening and kind of gross at times. And I was on the edge of my seat sort of waiting for her to pull back the curtain, even though I kind of knew where this was going. And yeah, she kind of shows us what's really going on in this cabin. I mean, the film is rated PG-13, but I'll admit I had to check that after I saw the film, because some of the visuals are pretty, they're like pushing limits of gross out stuff sometimes. The director is Osgood Perkins, who has proved himself to be a pretty reliable director. He had a great film that played at our festival, actually, called The Black Coat's Daughter.
I love that movie.
And he did a film that's on Netflix called I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, which is a bit more like purely scary. But yeah, the two kids are really great, and Alice Krieg obviously is terrific. I had to actually figure out when it was I saw her last in a role this big. But yeah, this works more than it doesn't. It's certainly lacking in certain places. Like I said, it's not particularly scary, but I think it kind of makes up for it to a certain degree with just a great visual style. It doesn't overplay. The actors don't overplay the parts. It's not meant to be campy in any way. I'd say don't dismiss it just because it's PG-13 horror or because it's coming out in January. So.
Right. Okay, there you go. That's Gretel and Hansel. Eric and Steve. We got one more movie to review, and then we'll do the box office for the week. And it is the Nick DiGilio Show continuing right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN on a Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you would like to join us. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every Sunday night, Monday morning to review the new movies. We've got one more here to talk about, and then Eric and I will chat about the box office. All right, Steve.
Yes.
Tell us about the rhythm section.
Yeah, so Blake Lively stars as Stephanie Patrick, who's an ordinary British woman on the path of self-destruction after her parents and siblings are tragically killed in a plane crash that she later finds out was actually an act of terrorism. When she discovers that the crash was not an accident, thanks to a kindly reporter, she enters a very dark world to seek revenge on those responsible and find her own redemption with the help of a former MI6 agent who's played by Jude Law, who convinces her that rather than just go after the bomber, that she should also go after everyone responsible for arranging the bombing and why the bombing even happened in the first place. There's a pretty long list on that, but he trains her and gets her sort of in assassin shape, and then she kind of goes out into the world and starts killing people. The film kind of feels like a Luc Besson film that even he thought was a bit too cliche, and with this British accent, that Lively certainly does a convincing job of playing a drug addict, and she kicks a little butt in here in a bunch of action sequences. But beyond that, there's not really a whole lot going on here. It's just, weirdly enough, when the film ended, I thought, is this supposed to be a series? Like, is this going to be a franchise? Is that what they're hoping for here? And it turns out that this is based on a novel by a guy named Mark Burnell, who also wrote the screenplay. And it turns out that he actually has a series of books with this character. So I guess that's the hope. Also, it turns out that Barbara Broccoli, who does all the James Bond films, is a producer on this film. So she has some knowledge of how to put together a franchise. This might not be the best way, but the aspirations are certainly there, and you can sort of feel it. The ending leaves open that possibility. This is a sort of a hard R film, mostly for violence, and that's actually helps the film a little bit, but. There's a nice supporting turn in here by Sterling K. Brown as a former CIA agent who is now sort of an information broker, and he helps her out and gives her assassination assignments, some of which seem a little bit sketchy to her, but that's just the thing she has to do to get to reach the goal of killing the people that were responsible for killing her family. As much as she is fueled by revenge and grief, the film is lacking something sort of fundamentally interesting about its heroine. We don't really ever get to know her or who she is or who she was before her world fell apart. And we don't really get a sense of how far she has fallen. And the ending is so abrupt that to the point where I assumed it wasn't the real ending. I kept waiting for like a twist that never really showed up. And it did. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I guess that's it. All right. So, I'm sure somewhere buried in further books, there's an interesting character in there somewhere. I had trouble finding her, so I cannot quite recommend the rhythm section.
Yeah, I'm with you on this, and I'm a big fan of Blake Lively. I think she's great, and I was really looking forward to this movie, and I think she's fine in it. You know,
she's
it's not that the problem is not her, because she actually came to play.
Yeah,
the problem is that there's just a lack of anything. You know. Of anything, you know, convincing in it. And, the action sequences are fine. They're put together. Reed Morano directed this, and she did several episodes of Handmaid's Tale. She's been a cinematographer. She's a terrific cinematographer, and she's turned out to be a pretty good director. And she does a nice job with handling of the action scenes and stuff like that. Sterling K. Brown, I think, is great in it. Jude Law's second movie this week.
For
Jude Law. But I was really looking forward to this movie, and man, nobody went to see it.
Am I crazy about the ending, though? Did it just
anticlimactic? It is. It truly is. It truly is. And it did feel like when it was over, I was like, well, are they going to do another one of these? And it clearly, by the weekend's box office, I don't think they are going to do a series of it. But I was disappointed. I'm a big Blake Lively fan, so I'm with you, Steve. I can't quite recommend it. So, all right, what do we got next week?
Birds of Prey.
All right. The Harley Quinn movie. That's right.
Yes.
Okay. All right, Steve. Thank you, man.
Yes. Sure thing.
All right, Eric. Let's talk box office.
Yes.
Bad Boys for Life.
Yeah.
And now officially the biggest January opening of all time?
It was the big, well, the, yeah, technically the biggest, you know, like, I mean, people point at American Sniper, which opened wide in January, but was technically a December release, because that was a limited release. But yeah, Bad Boys for Life is now the highest grossing, like, standalone January release of all time.
Man.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's doing well, it's headed, it's potentially headed for a $200 million payday, which is quite extraordinary, because I didn't know if this movie was still going to have enough in the tank, and, you know, people seem to like it, I guess.
I guess. What is it, when was the Bad Boys 2?
2003.
2000, so it's been a long time.
17 years.
Wow. And yeah. Man, people still want to see these movies. Yeah. 17.6 million this weekend. Number two is 1917. With,
yeah, doing very well. Headed for possibly over $150 million. So that's actually, that was also technically a December release, but, you know, that's doing terrific business. And considering that it's probably going to win a whole bunch of Oscars next weekend, it's probably going to, you're probably going to see it in the top 10 probably until early March.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because it's probably going to win Best Picture. So
I think so.
Number three is Doolittle. 7.7 million, 55 million total. Why?
Yeah, I guess the weird silver lining is that this is the only other film this year or standalone release to gross over $25 million. That's how weak January has been.
Wow.
That Doolittle, you know, if this movie didn't cost $175 million, $55 million for a movie that people don't, you know, think is terrible, you know, people would be like, I'll take that. I'll take a minor loss on this, but this movie costs $175 million, conservatively.
Yeah.
So this movie is headed for all-time status.
Number four, Gretel and Hansel with $6
million. Yeah, that is part of the horror doldrums that we've gotten for January. I mean, The Grudge didn't do well, Underwater didn't do well, The Turning, which is still in the top 10, is not doing well, and yeah, it's only a $5 million budgeted film. It looks a lot more than $5 million, the imagery in the movie.
Yeah.
But no one's going to, you know, raise any arms for a $6 million opening.
Yeah. By the way, it's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking box office with Eric Childress, as we do every week. Number five, The Gentleman with $6 million, bringing its total up to 20.4.
Another one's kind of a shoulder shrug. It's not really, it's very middle of the road, not really a hit, not really a bomb, just kind of there. And, you know, if it's in theaters, I guess people will just go see it out of curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Number six, Jumanji, The Next Level.
This is a hit.
Yeah, big hit.
This one is headed the $300 million, not as much as the last movie did. That movie almost made $1 billion and did over $400 million domestically, but $300 million domestic, and it's going to be passing $750 million worldwide. You'll be seeing another Jumanji film out of this crew.
They really, I mean, it's amazing how much money these movies make.
Yeah.
Number seven, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. 3.1 million, 507 million domestically.
Yeah, and it's weird that this is kind of going to be labeled a bit of a disappointment. And I think that the because of the word of mouth on this, it's not just because there was some weird Last Jedi backlash. I think there are people that were generally not crazy about this movie, so there was not a lot of repeat business. I mean, still $500 million and over $1 billion, but if you had bet me last year that Joker was going to make more money than The Rise of Skywalker, I would have said you're crazy.
Yeah, no. Number eight, you mentioned it, The Turning, horror movie, $3 million, $11 million total.
Yeah, another horror shrug.
Yeah. Number nine, Little Women, $3 million, almost up to $100 million. That's a pretty solid hit.
Yeah, that's going to pass $100 million this week, and Greta Gerwig is going to join a very exclusive group of women directors who have made $100 million grossing films.
Mm, amazing. Number 10, The Rhythm Section, which we just talked about, $2.8 million, and nobody went to see that.
Yeah, and this is actually historic, actually. This is, I mean, Rhythm Section just entered infamy this weekend because it's the lowest grossing film ever released, for an opening weekend at least, on a film released in over 3,000 theaters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
The per theater average of this movie is estimated at $918.
Oof.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the first 3,000-plus theater opening to have a PTA under $1,000.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I guess it's not going to be. I guess it's not going to be a series of movies then.
Oh, I don't think so. And this movie cost $50 million too.
It cost $50
million? $50 million reportedly.
Oh, man, oh man. All right. Well, what are we looking at next week? I mean, obviously, Birds of Prey will be number one.
Yeah, Birds of Prey should be number one. There's estimates right now that's thinking low 50s. I think it might even be do a little bit more than that. I think the Suicide Squad, I don't know, I don't know anyone who likes that movie, but people certainly went and saw it.
Yeah.
And I think at the very least, anyone who had any thoughts about the movie thought that Margot Robbie was the best thing about it.
Without question.
Right. So maybe that'll propel enough people. It's going to be very easy number one next week.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm actually looking forward to it.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
From people that I have, my comic book friend apparently is not too wild about what seems to be going on with it.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right, Eric. Thanks, man.
Sure thing.
All right, Eric Childress. We talk box office every week and review the movies with Steve and Eric.